Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have, like, a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. Today we have a special guest for all of you. We're joined by Jerry V, who is a 22-year NBA analyst, writer for NOLA.com, and former coach. Jerry V, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
So we've had a whole lot going on in the offseason this year. We wanted to get some other opinions as to, you know, whether we should be really excited about what this team has done, get an idea of what an actual coach and person who's followed the Hornets for so long and seen all kinds of different iterations of this team, how you feel this team is progressing and what kind of timeline we should be expecting. There's been a real major uptick in expectations to the point where, you know, a lot of people are talking playoffs this year, whether that's a realistic thing or whether that's not realistic. So, Jerry, just general impressions. How do you feel about what the Hornets front office has done this offseason?
Well, I love the draft. I think everybody loves the Anthony Davis acquisition for everything that he brings, because he will eventually address some of the deficiencies on his Hornet basketball team. One, they needed a rim protector. They needed a player that fits the new mold, the new style of what's happening on the front line of the NBA. And I like what he does. Defensively, you'll like him. So that's going to help you defensively, because as we go on tonight, we'll elaborate on how he further adds to this team. The Austin Rivers acquisition at number 10 potentially gives you another ingredient that was lacking on this club. An attack off the dribble type guy, potentially now, and I use the word potential very carefully until we can see him under real fire, because I think he'll be a nice player, but I don't want to put too much pressure on the youngsters in their rookie year. But the potential for the attack off the dribble, short clock, get my shot kind of a guy, coming off real good pedigree because of his basketball background. So that was a requirement as well. And will he eventually evolve into a combo-type guard that can give you some moments at the one? Because of right now, I'm not sold at all that you could dare put him as a point guard position to run your offense. Not yet.
Yeah. So that's like the first position I always come to when I'm thinking about the team as where I feel like we have the biggest hole is really point guard. I mean, I like Grievous Vasquez. I like what he gives us. I don't think any time point last year I said, well, that guy's definitely a starting point guard in the NBA. And we don't have anybody else on the team right now other than Rivers who can legitimately give us any minutes at the point guard. I guess Eric Gordon.
Eric Gordon can get you some moments at the one. You can do that. It'll take away from some of his other effectiveness, because remember, you can change the role. You can have another advance the ball, go to Gordon, then allow him to play from there. But as far as Eric Gordon taking the burden of running an offense, setting everybody up, I think that will diminish what you need from him, and that's to have that major scoring punch, because he's a guy night to night that can get you 18 to 22, even more per game. So, yeah, he can give you some play at the one, but I wouldn't want to limit him extensively and take away chances to move without the ball, run him out of the pick and roll, and let him be a primary scorer for this Hornet offense. On the Vasquez comment, I like him as a player, but you can't ignore the fact when you go back and look at some game tape, and I like to measure teams against the best seven teams that you play. The personnel, how do you match up? And what I saw last year is that when the teams would come at him and trap him and it slowed down your tempo, he doesn't have the consistent escape game to break up traps, get to the lane consistently enough, put pressure on the defense, and make the play. He can do it in spurts, but remember, we measure talent based on an 82-game scale, not just a one-game performance. I like him. I think he'd be a solid backup to run your second unit and then to back up your primary guard. So I still think the organization will explore that point guard position. Now, if they don't find something that they like that fits in, they might hold serve for a while. But I'm still holding my – I'm still of the school of thought that that's a position that is still lacking for the skill sets that they need.
So a question about that. I do a lot of statistical analysis and look at – I mean, there's all those different tools that you have available on the internet now that are crazy.
Yeah, I use crayons. Sometimes it works.
One of the oddest things that I noticed was that Jarrett Jack versus Grievous Vasquez, almost every single statistical measure out there ranked Vasquez as – a better player than him, both on the defensive end on the ball and on the offensive end of the ball. Is that something, I mean, does that mesh with what you saw out there at all?
Valid stat, but let's put it in the proper box. Valid stat, look at wins and losses. You have to look at time score, margin differential, caliber of the competition. Some of those stats, and I'm like you, I like to deep dive into stats, break them down, and look for trends and accompany that with some video. While both had some positive measurements, both were not pure ones. There's so many ways you can look at that. Jarrett Jack, to me, is a six-man type tempo guy coming off the bench to ignite and help disrupt the ball game. He wasn't the pure one. Grievous had some wonderful moments last season. But then again, I extrapolate a lot of those, and I will compare him. What teams do you have to get through to get into the playoffs? I like the stats that measure you against the best seven or eight teams that you play against and what the matchups are. That's where the real story is, because that's the caliber of competition you have to fight through when you aspire to become a playoff team. So part of the story, the numbers you said, are very true, and they're very educational. And then you got to take it another layer or two when you're making the decision of trying to become a legitimate multi-round playoff team.
And Jared, I guess I'm thinking about you using the phrase "pure one," and if you could kind of expand on that, would you consider a Russell Westbrook, or I know Tony Parker kind of evolved his game this past year, but in the championship years with the Spurs, would you consider those two guys pure ones, or are they more of the attacking guard that you're saying that Austin Rivers could become?
See, that's a great question, because that's the question of this new era of basketball. And I put up something on HornetsReport.com where I broke down, and I'll do it by position, but the first thing I said was about point guards. A pure one based on the system you are asked to play in, because we're seeing a difference. If we look at Oklahoma City, we see a team that likes to play in the open floor, and they don't have many set-up half-court type situations. They like to play off the rebound, advance the pass, attack. That's why they led the NBA in free throw rate. They were the free throw rate. They were the best in the league in doing so. And they got and getting to the line because of their ability to attack the lane, drive and kicks, got them to the line and got the three balls. So in that regard, he's the pure one. The old school definition is there's so many intangibles in a pure one. A pure one to me, though, regardless of the style, has to have vocal leadership, you know, pure ball handling skills, change of direction, pass off the dribble, terrific court vision that can see corner to corner. Those are intangibles you must have, as well as the ability to get foul line to foul line in the open floor, enough acceleration to separate from the defense, break up traps, execute to pick and roll. Styles are different. I love Tony Parker. I love Westbrook. Some look at the pure one as the walk it up type playmaker. But those are some of the skill sets that I just mentioned a pure one must have. And then how does that particular player translate or transfer those skills to a particular style? That's why you'll see some point guards fit better in one style versus another. I hope I answered the question properly for you.
Yeah, that's absolutely perfect. And when you were talking about Westbrook and how he fit with Oklahoma City, I mean, we were kind of forced to watch the summer league, and you try not to take too much away from that. But the first thing I noticed in Austin Rivers' first summer league game is he actually drew 11 fouls against the opposing team, which if you think about that throughout the course of the game, and especially with the, you know, addition of Ryan Anderson and Anthony Davis, two big men
right.
to hit their free throws. You know, if Austin Rivers is attacking, he might not be a traditional point guard, but if he could get his team into the penalty early in quarters, I think, you know, that's just as much as a Chris Paul
lob. Oh, absolutely. It is absolutely an invaluable stat. It's like the extra 401k contribution somebody puts into your account, because once you get into that bonus, it's like having an extra player on the floor. I agree wholeheartedly. Once again, when you look at the summer league, and I watched all the games with Austin, I look at the caliber of competition guarding him, when, where, and how he drew those fouls. I love his passion off the catch to go at people. But where we can't categorize him, we go back to that pure one debate, is off the catch, while he goes to the attack, he still lacks the vision, which I call running the horizon, being able to see left to right to what's developing below him. He didn't do that at Duke either, because at Duke, it was required of him to score the ball. And I watch a lot of ACC basketball because of all the years I spent in the state of North Carolina. But your point is very valid. But the other thing, too, when you're looking at that point guard, understand pace, when to run it, when to walk it, understanding who's hot, where to direct the ball, vocal personality that can direct, basketball IQ, understanding shot clock, timeouts remaining, being able to berate a teammate if necessary, how to feed the post, all little skill sets, regardless if you play up-tempo or if you play half-court. So he still has to master those. But let's keep in mind, too, guys, right? He's only 19 years old.
Right.
He's only 19, and he's got a lot of growing to do. But it's still fun to talk about it, because now between the three of us, we'll have a basis to look at him and see where he will be the next season and the season after that. That's one of the joys of the game, is to measure out these good young players.
So just to wrap up the point guard consideration, do you think the team will be picking up another point guard?
I think they're looking now. I think they're looking. They've been very thorough. They're investigating that possibility, because as other teams start to have their real camps, I call them the real camps, teams will discover that they may have an abundance of players that they need to change to maybe a duplication at a particular position. It could be the point guard. There might be a trade later on. But I think they're carefully looking at that, because, guys, they played at the slowest pace in the league last year.
Yeah.
And while their defense looked solid as far as points allowed, as far as defensive efficiency on letting teams get to the line, points allowed, field goal percentage into two and three, offensive rebounding rate, their defense was 16th in the league. So they were middle of the pack, and there were a few reasons for that. And that slow pace kind of hides what some of the real story is behind their defensive performance. Even though they played with great passion, great intensity, put a lot of pressure on their offense because they didn't get enough shots.
Yeah, I did some work there, and it seemed like if they could have just managed to hold down their turnovers, they would have had a much better defense than they had.
Oh, yeah, and turnovers during critical moments.
Yeah.
They didn't shoot the three enough near the bottom of the league, which really hurts you. You must be able to shoot the three in the NBA with where this game is evolving. Because if you can't, it negates the efficiency of your drive and kick, swing the ball, skip pass, force rotating defenders, go to the open three. If you're not a three-ball threat, teams can shorten their rotations. Teams could crowd the lane. Teams become more effective defensive rebounding teams because you don't have the ability to punish them and stretch them out and force their defenders to come out at you and travel a longer distance.
So talking about that three-point thing, and this is almost academic now that Ryan Anderson has joined the team.
Right.
But Jason Smith was always the pick-and-pop master. He sat out there similar to David West. He could hit that, 20-footer just a few steps inside the three-pointer. And it's always bothered me. People always talk about how players have certain range.
Yeah.
Is there really a huge difference between having a guy spot up at 20 feet and a guy spot off at 22 feet, 6 inches? Does that really completely shatter their ability to hit those shots?
Yeah, it can because, number one, and by the way, one thing Jason Smith is putting in a ton of hours in this summer is that corner three.
Wow.
The shortest three on the floor, which I'm curious to look at that. But that extra 2 feet and 6 inches, a little lift in the legs, a little more float on the release, it can be mastered, but sure, because if you can take a guy off a sweet spot by a foot, that can alter his shooting percentage. It can do can inflict a lot of damage on a guy's offensive efficiency in doing so. So, yeah, it forces you maybe a little quicker release, get a little more lift, a little more arc on the ball. Guys can adapt to that at the pro level if they have the skills. And I think Jason Smith can be one. I'm really curious to see how that evolves in this offseason because I think he's a much better player than some people give him credit for.
Right. He's one of our favorites.
I love him. He's a wonderful personality and just such an engaging guy. He's one of my favorites on the team.
Yeah, I loved when Monty, after he flattened Blake Griffin, Monty said how he didn't think Jason Smith could crush a grape. But so, yeah, so, Monty's got some great one-liners.
Yes, he does. Monty's got a tremendous sense of humor when you sit down with him. And I've had some long conversations with him, and he is very funny. You should see him try to do Christopher Walken. It's absolutely the worst imitation that I have ever seen because I tried to teach him. And he just failed miserably in trying to do that. So the next time you see him, ask him, say, I hear you do a good Christopher Walken, and watch him just bow his head in embarrassment.
Well, we know you could do a great Christopher Walken. Can you do an impersonation of Monty Williams doing a Christopher Walken impersonation?
Oh, it's so bad, I'd have to get a tetanus shot before I even attempted doing that.
So to go back on what we started with, and this has kind of been something that Hornets fans have fallen into a trap of, is, yeah, that draft was Anthony Davis and Austin Rivers, and it's almost like Anthony Davis is a sure thing. Mm-hmm. We know he's going to be a superstar, so we talk about all the other parts on the team. But when you've talked about Anthony Davis for a little bit at the beginning of this, I noticed that you didn't classify him as a certain position. You talked about him as a defensive frontline player for this new era of basketball. Talk a little bit about where you see the NBA going and where Anthony Davis fits in.
It's a good question because it was a topic of some fun discussion throughout the summer on a variety of talk shows. Unless you have a Bynum, a Dwight Howard, you take those guys and put them aside. Anthony, I told guys this summer, and I've said it on a variety of shows I've been on, they said, who are we going to get at center? Who's going to be our center? Who's going to be our center? Everybody was concerned. I said, I could live with four guys along the front line that are 6'10", 6'11", but they're mobile enough, and they develop into efficient rotating defenders. Because I have a commandment. A lot of people don't realize Moses had this written on the other side of the tablet in front of the top 10 commandments, that your defense in the NBA is only as good as your help and rotating defenders. So with Anthony Davis, they'd go, can he be our center? He's not big enough, not strong enough. Well, he'll get wiry strong. He already has put on more muscle and weight since the draft. I call him just a frontline rim protector. I think he has the makings of being an excellent rotating defender. Sure, he'll have a hard time against a heavier type of frontline player, but that's why they signed Lopez, just to obstruct people. He's going to be a good help defender, shot blocker, alter shots, which is a requirement here. He's going to be mobile enough and fluid enough to help against dribble penetrators, and also fluid enough to go out and become that help defender closing back out on the basketball, which we saw at the college level when we saw him run out and block threes and jump shots in the lane. So if we want to label him a 4, a 4-5, do that. I just labeled him as a defending frontline player who's also going to have, a nice offensive contribution. Not monster numbers, but nice enough, because I think that's where the game goes. You know, you look at Oklahoma City. You look at Perkins. But Perkins' value diminished, and now it goes up. Now that Howard is with the Lakers, because Perkins is going to be able to bang in the box with Howard because that's his best style of play. But when it came to running, which Davis can do, changing ends of the floor, going from high to low post, a closeout defender, rotating defender, shot blocker, he can fit all those qualities. So I just call him a modern-era frontline player. I'm going to try to patent that definition.
Right.
Right.
So you're talking right up Michael's alley. He's been pounding that drum all summer.
Hey, I stopped defining players numerically as one. I've called twos and threes swings for over 15 years. The first guy to do that before 15 years was Dean Smith. In fact, right. Dean Smith is the guy that came up with the points per possession, because at my very first coaching job, I was 22 years old. I sat in his office. And he told me and explained how they charted at Carolina the points per possession and offensive efficiency, and he never gets full credit for that. And that's how I first started devising my charts. But I was taught back then, and Coach Krzyzewski stopped doing it years ago as well, but being around those guys taught me, shed the numerical stuff. Maybe you keep the one, and you separate positions by skill sets, and then go from there, because that's where the game's going.
So this is the biggest bone of contention, and I know this is how people like to talk about the game.
Sure.
Starting lineup for the Hornets. Mm-hmm. I am of the opinion, and I think Michael's along the ride with me, that we will see, it doesn't actually matter who starts, it matters who ends, but I don't actually see – Lopez was brought in, and everybody has now designated him as – starting center. That's his role. He'll be our starting center. Mm-hmm. I don't see him necessarily getting more than 15, 20 minutes a game unless, like you say, he has a matchup that is advantageous. You know, he actually can bang with Bynum
or
something like that.
I think you're right, and I think you're absolutely correct. I know, having coached on the high school and the college level, you discover the value of a player when it's money time. And you may start a guy to get him going because it's good for his confidence and, you know, how he gets out of the gate. But there might be another guy that's on your bench as the game begins that's the guy you'll have on the floor when games are on the line. So I totally agree with you. And minute distributions come by particular matchups, and you try to bluff other teams to alter their matchup. And when we talk about the Dwight Howard signing, I'll show you how my opinion why that's more than invaluable for the Lakers. But I agree with you. You can talk about all the starters you want, but in this day and age, you need flexibility, and flexibility in your lineup to match skill sets, and that's going to be determined time and score in the late stages of games, because some guys are made up differently psychologically. Some guys don't care if they start, but they want to be on the floor when it's crunch time. And coaches know that. So I think your point is a valid one. And if I were you, I would stick to it, because I know I will.
Yeah, and the thing that I guess I don't get is a lot of times we talk about, you know.
By the way, this is the first podcast I've ever done that's fully catered. Beautiful spread you have here. just the fans could see it.
Enjoy. Keep on eating.
Thank you.
But no, we talk a lot about the Hornets fans have worries on the defensive end when an Anderson-Davis combo goes against, let's say, an Andrew Bynum, somebody you brought up. But don't the Hornets have the bigger advantage on the other end? I mean, Andrew Bynum or big lumbering centers like him are horrible in the pick and roll. They're horrible getting out on shooters. I mean, Andrew Bynum, I would think as a coach, it would be a bigger nightmare for me to have Andrew Bynum covering Ryan Anderson than the opposite, because I could always double down on Bynum and just make sure my rotations are quick. I mean, do you see it that way too, that maybe we're not exploring?
Yeah, you bring up a good point. And in the point you bring up, what you've done, you just peel back and reveal to the fans why it's a beautiful game and where the mental and where the psychology plays in. Case in point, let's look at the matchup you just said about Howard. So if Anderson is drilling him, you force a substitution, or you have to bring someone in and put Howard on somebody else. If Anderson is not, well, then advantage Howard. So can you get something from someone else on the floor? That's the beauty of the game. That's why coaches are so meticulous right now on how they chart what's happening offensively based on certain matchups and different personnel packages. So if Anderson is lighting you up, advantage. You force a move by the other club. And I like your way of thinking, because it's not always, you know, fans tend to think they'll go, okay, so who are we going to match up with him? What are we going to do? Well, fine. When the game, it's a game that changes ends of the floor, right? Where is the advantage if the game is changing ends of the floor? And the Hornets want to play at a faster pace this year. If they continue to play at the pace they played last year, I'd be very worried. But they've acquired guys now that are going to change that for them. And you know, for example, you'll go, well, what about Davis? How is he going to defend a big, strong front liner if there's two of them on the floor? And let's say Lopez is on the floor and he's got to guard one. Okay. Does that change an offensive team's concentration? Do they start to force feed the ball in the post to take advantage of Davis and disrupt their rhythm, their flow, and their offense? Can they do that? Is that going to upset another player on the floor? You see how the whole psychology evolves during a ball game?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what makes the game so beautiful. Sometimes think, I got the advantage on this. I'm going to make you have to adapt to what I'm going to do. And then that goes back to individual coaching philosophies. That's why there is so many facets to the game of basketball that keeps it so incredibly interesting and entertaining for me, and obviously for guys like yourself.
So you've mentioned this a couple times now. So Monty has been a part of two different teams, with the Spurs and with Portland.
Right.
Who generally, when he was with them at least, were setting records for being the slowest teams ever.
Right.
I mean, they walked the ball up. Even with Tony Parker, it was always surprising to see how slow those Spurs teams played. And the Hornets, under both of his seasons, have been a very slow team.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you expect him – I mean, so is that – is that his philosophy, or is that was just what he had for material?
Because
that's what
we're
trying to look for.
Yeah, dictated by talent. Because look how San Antonio's accelerated their pace.
Mm-hmm.
They changed dramatically.
So you fully expect that Monty will be putting in a much quicker attack?
They're going to try to. They need to get more possessions per game. They need to get to the line more, and they need to shoot the three, because they put too much pressure on their defense night in and night out. And over 82 games, that's excruciating. And you can look and say, wow, but they lost several close games. Yeah, but imagine if they could make the three, if they could have gotten to the line more, how that would have taken pressure to fill those empty possessions. He wants to play faster. Not that it's going to be hell-bent, you know, damn the torpedo style. You can't do that unless you have a primary ball handler that can advance the ball. But he wants to. They need to. Too much pressure over 82 games.
So there's one final position that's a big hole.
Sure.
Some would say that Al-Farouq Aminu's best possible situation is to be on a team that runs,
mm-hmm.
that's always attacking, because he has all the length and all the speed in the world.
Right.
Do you see Al-Farouq Aminu as a actual potential starting small forward for this team
long term? I have a big question mark next to his name.
Okay.
Generally, you want guys coming into camp with an exclamation point at the end of their name. He has a question mark. Decision making has to improve. Although I agree with your point that in the open floor, it disguises some of his efficiencies where he doesn't have to make the quick decision. He can catch it, run, and get to the rim. He's shown moments of being a decent defender, a decent off-the-ball defender, and then he's shown moments where he could do neither of those two. He's shown moments where he'll make the open shot. He's shown moments where he couldn't hit the barn. There are times he can put it on the floor with a bounce or two, finish a play. There are other times his decision-making is absolutely horrible. What is all that equal? Lack of consistency. There's an uncertainty to his game as to what to do when the opening is there, similar to a running back when he comes to the professional level and discovers the hole in the line is going to be open, but only for a blink. It's not going to be as long as in the college game because the players in the pros are much quicker and faster. They're going to close it out. I'm very curious as to what he's going to come back with this season, because if he can come back and make some positive contributions, that would be a tremendous asset to this basketball team.
Yeah, and this has always kind of been a theory of mine. You see the Spurs bringing in young guys or even guys that other teams gave up on, and they're suddenly very good in San Antonio. My theory has always been, well, there's enough talent to where these young guys get to just play a specific role as opposed to having to do more than they're capable of. More talent on this Hornets team, you have defined three-point shooting, you have a rim protector, you have, you know, all of these pieces that Dellar is assembling. Is it possible that with a more defined role, Alfaro could, you know, slightly take off?
Oh, sure. And a lot of it, too, is in the timing. When guys change teams, different culture, different atmosphere, sometimes a guy needs to get his heart broken before he can discover how good he can be. Maybe he felt he wasn't working as hard. Maybe the change of atmosphere helps him mentally. Competition he competes against. It's like when you put on a brand new suit or something that you get is brand new, that good feeling you get with it. And your point about specific roles is right on. It's invaluable because you don't want to ask players to do something they can't do. And if you can find what he does well, where he's more comfortable, and if he's in a style of play that helps disguise what he can't do, he becomes the player. So let's say if you just ask him, here's what I want you to do. Anything that goes up on the glass, just go get it. And then I want you to change ends of the floor, and I want you to be a rim runner. Run to the front of the rim. We'll try to get you the ball. And I want you to be a slasher. I want you to cut, catch, get to the lane, go to the defense, get to the rim. And I want you to do that for me 14 to 17 minutes a game. And I want you to play as hard as you can for as long as you can, because I'm only going to use you 14 to 17 minutes. That might be the best thing for him. Instead of that way he knows. He doesn't have to preserve energy. And they know exactly what their minute package is going to be. That could be the best world for him.
So 14 to 17 minutes, that, of course, leaves
and
a
I'm
lot
just
of
throwing
minutes.
That out. I'm just throwing the number out. But, you know, you give the guy a definitive number. Look, you're going to go in there for a 10-possession trip. 10 possessions. You busted for those 10 possessions. We're going to chart your deflections, your defensive stops, your rebounds, how many times your guy catches the ball, how many times you sprint the floor. We're going to chart all of that. Now, when we sit down and do our tape study, we're going to look at those 10 possessions that you're on the floor, and we're going to grade you. And then that player starts to see what it's all about. And that's a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff that goes down with your tape study. So he starts to truly understand what his role is, and then all of a sudden you see Aminu start to excel, maybe in just two areas of the game, but then that makes him a better player because he feels better about it.
Yeah, I'd love to be a fly on a wall when they were telling them what they expected out of each of these players.
Oh, let me tell you, I've chatted with guys, players, and coaches through the years, and you have long conversations with them, and it's similar with at the college level, where I would sit down with you, and I would say, okay. We're going to pull out 15 of these possessions that you played. Let's see what you did. And the tape is edited, and I show you what you did offensively, and I show you what you did defensively. And then I ask you, I'm going to give you your 14 minutes a night. That's all you're going to get. But I need an A game for you for 14 minutes. Now, you go into the game as a crazy man. Hey, I'm going to go 14 minutes. I can explode my lungs. I might get 4 minutes here, 5 minutes here. I'm just going to bust it. And then all of a sudden, you become invaluable coming off the bench. It's amazing how the psychology of all of that influences players and just elevates their hunger, and they start to feel so good about themselves, they become more efficient. Because you explain to them, if you're going to get me 14 minutes and you get me 6 points, four rebounds, a deflection, a steal, some closeouts defensively, you're an important player to me. And that's all part of the coaching psychology. And Monty, by the way, does a very good job of that, and so does Greg Popovich.
So I think that leads to one of a question that's been preying on both Michael and I's minds. Mm-hmm. Marcus Thornton.
Mm-hmm.
So you were close to the team when all that was going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he's still a tremendous fan favorite. There are still people who watch Sacramento Kings games because
sure.
he plays for them. What went wrong? Because it was my opinion that while he wasn't an A-list player in any shape or form, he was probably the most talented shooting guard we had on the team at the time between him, Bellinelli, and Willie Green.
Right.
But he got the least amount of minutes.
Right.
So what was going on there? Can you give us a scoop on that?
Sure. I think overall individual discipline of getting to practice, if it's a critical time and I go, run two slip hook, and he's like, what? Wrong way, wrong cut. Head turning on defense. He'll hit a jumper. He'll hit a three. He'll get a dunk. Then he'll give up 6 points on his defensive matchups. He'll make a great play to a bad play. He was one of those guys where you put in the game and you go, all right, disrupt the game. When he was hot, the sweet shot disguised a lot of the things he wasn't doing well. And I used to watch him. And then following the game, I go back and look at the game tape. I just lock in on Marcus, and I'd go, whoa, he just gave up a couple of blazes. He'd make a three, get a steal, get a dunk. Then he'd be a victim of a blow-by. And then he'd turn the head the wrong way, and a weak side cutter would catch it right at his nose and lay it in or dunk. So he was giving, but he was also giving. And the consistency there, it just becomes frustrating for a coach. And then there's more at practice and the whole deal, and you go, well, come on now. And he just wanted to rely. And he's a wonderful guy. I mean, I've chatted with him. He's a wonderful guy. It's just he couldn't quite put them in a position of, can we trust you when this game is on the line? You had to go to him at times because he was the only firepower you had. And then I saw more of that at Sacramento. And that
yeah.
style is perfect for him, but you got to live. You got to live. He's like a J.R. Smith type. And when George Karl told me, I said, how do you and J.R. Smith is a playful little puppy, a wonderful kid, if you can tolerate him. I said to George Karl, how do you tolerate with some of the asinine stuff he does on the floor? You know what he said? I know I can live with him, whatever the time capsule they allow him to play. If I live with him 14, 18 minutes a game. And I know all hell might break loose, but I'll live with that, but I won't live with it longer than that so I can minimize his mistakes. Because there's certain guys you hope just catch fire for you to disrupt the game, but we don't see the coach after the game taking the Advil.
Right.
So this is a topic I think that's becoming a recurring one, is the psychology of the game, which, again, just can't be simulated when people play these matchups on paper.
Right. The game is part of coaching. There's thousands of guys that can X and O. Thousands of guys that can teach. I have an old saying. It's getting the fat wallet to play.
Mm.
And it's getting these guys to give you what you need on a consistent basis and nursing some of them and massaging an ego to understand and who can take the constructive criticism, who can't, and understanding where are the buttons to push on certain personalities. That's the toughest part of coaching at any level. It's the most challenging,
and that's perfect. You hit just on it. So I think the part of this offseason that is going to be the biggest X factor, looking back on whether it was a great offseason or, you know, just a good one, is the Hornets did put another fat wallet, as you call it, on the roster. They gave Eric Gordon $58 million.
Right.
Even after he said that his heart was in another city, he also, in an interview with us, questioned Dell Demps by saying, you know, by effectively saying, what big men do we have on this roster? Why did we take Rivers at number 10 instead of a big? You know, so you've got a guy who is a little petulant. He got paid $58 million despite only playing 9 games the year before.
Right.
And to be frank and honest, if this team is going to be a championship team, Anthony Davis is going to be its best player 3, 4, 5 years from now, and that's something else Eric Gordon will have to deal with. With all of that in mind, if you were a coach, if you were Monty, how would you kind of, you know, massage this situation as we kick off this season after a little drama?
Well, number one, I'd sit down and I would show him game tape of Oklahoma City. I would show him the Lakers. I would show him Miami. I would show him San Antonio. Let's just use those teams, okay? And then I would ask him, how many all-stars, highly talented individuals, are on the floor for those teams? And you can look at Ginobili, you can look at Parker and Duncan. Miami, we know about the trio, right? You go with the Lakers now, look at the arsenal they have. You go to Oklahoma City, and you have Westbrook, you have Harden, you have Durant, you have Ibaka, and nice personnel off the bench. Then I would ask him, now, did you see all that game tape? Let me ask you something. Which one of those teams do you think would win a title with one alpha dog?
Hmm.
And then I'd wait for his answer. And he's going to say, none of them. And then I tell him, let's look at you. Now, what can you do for this team? You can attack off the dribble. You can run the pick and roll. You can shoot the three. You can run the club occasionally as a secondary type point guard. And you are my short clock guy. Because late in the shot clock, I know I can put the ball in your hands and you can get your own shot. Then I'll ask him, do you want to carry that burden for 82 games plus the playoffs? And then I tell him, what about the nights when you shoot the ball and it's in the air and it's not going in? Don't you think we need guys that can go get it? And then I ask him, when you're being trapped and defenses start to plan for you out of respect because you're a very good offensive player, think of the wear and tear you save when you throw that swing pass to another guy that can also attack off the dribble. Do you see what that does for you over 82 games? I need you. You're very good. You can be our guy. But you see the way the game is now? Nobody dances alone in this game. And I think he'll come to comprehend that because I think he just went, he allowed himself to be recruited. They threw out the red carpet. Phoenix threw the money down on the table. They showed some love. And I experienced that in college recruiting. And guys, there's certain guys that love to be recruited. They want that attention. I think in time now that he sees the aggressiveness of this Hornet roster on what their game plan is, I think he'll start to buy in and realize and go, whoa, I never live in this league if I'm by myself.
Right.
I think he'll learn to comprehend that. Eventually they do. The ones that don't eventually just wear out, and their value in game diminishes. And then I'm hoping he's got a healthy mentor that's not even on the coaching staff, some presence in his life that can look at him and say, you got talent. You played 9 games. You got 58 mil, and they need you. And let that settle in.
That was funny. When you said healthy mentor, the first thing I thought you were actually talking about somebody who could mentor him on how to stay healthy.
Well, you know, I mean, for the guy, you know, here's what's happened. Players want people to be honest with them, but some players can't handle the truth. Eventually they can. And the existence at the professional level is so cold-hearted and relentless. And I've covered the NBA and been around players and games for 22 years, and then I coached for 16 at the Division I level. And you go and you talk to guys, and I've been around people that are 10 times smarter than me, where I pick their brains clean through the years. And eventually it boils down to being honest with a player. And there's different delivery styles to use. But Eric Gordon is a valuable commodity to this club. But when they look at that game tape and you look at those teams that want to win titles, look at those rosters. You think Kobe Bryant is complaining in Los Angeles that they got Dwight Howard? You think Pau Gasol is complaining they got Dwight Howard? You see the wear and tear and the pounding it's going to take off them? You think Kobe's upset because Steve Nash is getting all this media attention? Are you kidding me? You tell guys you need assets on your roster because it makes you play better. It helps you. It saves your legs, your energy, your health. And they eventually get the message, unless their character is so built or they won't. But I don't think Eric Gordon is a bad character, because I think in there he's a good kid.
Yeah, and I think most would agree. I guess just personally, you have been around the league plenty. Where do you fall on this debate of is staying healthy, is that a skill or is that just pure luck? Are you afraid at all, you know, looking at Gordon's injury history, that this is – going to be something that's recurring, or injuries just luck in the NBA, or lack
that's
of
that's a great question. It's a little bit of both. You know, some guys, I remember when Michael Jordan first came into the league, or David Thompson. I don't know if you remember the name David Thompson.
Yeah.
Nuggets.
I knew David Thompson ever since he was a high school player. And I saw Jordan, as a matter of fact, Freddie Lynch and Pop Herring, the two guys that coached Michael Jordan. I used to work basketball camps with them, and I had Michael Jordan at a basketball camp several years ago at Appalachian State University and saw him for the first time when the five-star camp was the best high school camp in the country. I used to lecture there, where I saw Michael Jordan destroy America, just simply destroy everybody. And this is the top 100, 150 players in the country. And all of his game, and the same with David Thompson, was played above the rim. They were always above the rim, their athleticism. And then it was explained to them, you can save the wear and tear. Then Jordan would add the mid-range game. Then he added the back-to-the-basket post-up game to save his legs. Some guys overexpose themselves, so they're prone to injury. Other guys adapt, change their game because they see that, why try to play everything up at the rim? Why try to dunk everything? I'm up in the air too much. I can get hurt. So part of it is luck. The other part is adapting your game and style to the rigors and the demands of an extensive schedule.
Do you think that if Eric Gordon adapts his game, we'll be losing? Because, I mean, in a lot of ways, like Dwayne Wade, those are the two players that they like kind of look the same to me on the court.
Yeah.
The way they attack the rim,
yep.
The way they have like that big Euro step move that they execute. But both of them end up on the floor all the time. Wade has had injury after injury. But if he played any other way, I don't know if he'd be what he is for the
Great
Heat.
Great point. You know, you can't go from being a rhythm and blues guy or a guy that loves hip hop and then all of a sudden overnight, you know, start to love Wayne Newton records. You know, how's that analogy? Holy cow, where the hell did that come from? But you know, you can't dramatically alter the style. But as guys get older, they start. It's funny how the lesson comes later on in a career. You show them, look at this play here. Why'd you dunk here? You didn't need to dunk here. Why are you throwing your body into this guy here when you're up 14 with 6 minutes to go? You know, why are you attacking relentlessly here and diving on the floor? We're up 11 with 3 minutes to play. You know, while I love your hustle, you start to learn when and where to sacrifice your body because you want to extend that career a little bit, and that starts to come with savvy. Some guys will never get it. You know, they won't get it, and they'll just play and stay acrobatic, and God bless them if they love it. But some guys, Bird adapted, Magic did it, Jordan did it. A lot of guys tweaked it a little bit just to save some of the wear and tear of their game.
All right, so I think one last thing we need to talk about, because this will impact the Hornets in the future.
I tell you what, guys, if I don't get back on the air within the next 2 months, because I can't move, the entire family is from New Orleans, you will see me on a street corner with a little organ grinding, making believe I'm doing a talk show. I've been doing talk radio for 19 years, and it's the story of just what happened the last time is a chapter in itself. But so if you ever see me dribbling out of the side of my mouth and gurgling and talking strangely, just say, oh, don't worry, he's looking for a new gig.
All right. We'll find you a monkey if that
exactly.
happens.
Exactly.
So the Lakers,
right.
This big trade, buying them for Dwight Howard. So, again, people are talking the idea that the Hornets might make the playoffs this year or next year, that, you know, they're hoping for some really quick turnaround where the Hornets will be actually, you know, a contender for a championship in, say, you know, 3 or 4 years. So two questions there. A, is that reasonable? And B, do the Lakers getting Dwight Howard really have any bearing on how the Hornets should be planning their next few years?
Great question. You guys got some good stuff tonight. I'm really impressed. There's some great basketball talk. First question, getting to the playoffs, did you say a title within the next 2 years?
No, next 3 or 4 years, people are talking about being contenders for a title.
Well, when they say contenders, you're talking about a multiple-round playoff team, right?
Yeah, like someone who might be making a 4 seed, hopefully advancing second round, maybe even making it to the conference semifinals.
Well, I would like that to happen. To answer it directly, I can't fathom that yet in the next 3 years.
Okay.
Unless that backcourt is addressed, and we'll see how Davis will evolve. On paper, potentially, everybody likes to use the blueprint of Oklahoma City. So there's hope that that could happen. But remember, with Oklahoma City, they started to evolve, and they were meticulous in putting additions to that roster. So 3 years, you'll be in the playoffs. Contending for a title, see how talent evolves, how it accelerates, and what the chart of improvement is going to be. And
yeah,
then we'll
talk from
there.
It took 4 years before Paul could even do anything.
Oh, yeah, and Jordan waited 7, and you Phil Jackson, I sat down with Phil Jackson one day, and I asked him about winning a title. And I asked the same of Pat Riley, and their answers were fairly similar. And Pat Riley, in essence, they said, from day one of camp, preseason, regular season to a title, is the most excruciating emotional and physical journey you will ever take. So we got to see how hardened this team becomes. And then the other thing, too, is I'm hoping that they sit down with Monty Williams and extend the contract, because then you'll know you have some continuity in the blueprint that you want to design this club with.
Yeah.
Right.
That's why you see San Antonio with consistency. And consistency in the front office and in the coaching ranks, provided the bar graph shows improvement year to year, allows you to design the style of player you want, the system you want to play, and then the free agents can look in and see how they fit in. That would be a great, great help. Great, great help.
Yeah.
So there's part A.
Well, and the other part of this Dwight Howard trade and kind of how it ties to us is it seems like a lot of the people who had outrage with this trade, the kind of rhetoric is, what did we have a lockout for? Chris Paul gets traded to L.A. Dwight Howard goes to L.A.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
Derrick Williams stays in Brooklyn. All the stars are gravitating to these big markets. I mean, what really is the point of being a fan of the Milwaukee Bucks? Or,
if you're a Milwaukee fan, see, we can't look at the league universally. And, I'm sitting down here and going, I mean, I've followed all those teams, and I'll pull for the Bucks if I'm watching them play because of the time you spent with Scott Skiles. But basically what you do, you worry. And I grew up a New York Knicks fan, so I've been on medication for decades. But
I'm very sorry to hear that.
The days at the Garden, it's excruciating, and having grown up in New York. But now that you're a Hornet fan, you focus in on what the Hornets are doing. And allow me to answer the Dwight Howard thing. Is that going to affect what the Hornets do on the roster? Because I think that's a great question because it fits my philosophy. You design your roster to win a 7-game series. not a one-night stand. You also, when we got back to that statistical question earlier, you measure yourself against the best seven teams that you play against, and that tells you where you need to go. Part C of all of that, now that he's with the Lakers, you look at the Western Conference. Compare your roster to the teams you need to fight through in the Western Conference. Not right now, because you're building. That's why you monitor what teams do in the West, because those games are significant as far as your progress is concerned. So when you look at the best teams in the West, now ask yourself, what do they have that we don't have? Where can't we match up with them? And what would prevent us from beating that team in a seven-game series? And the reason I say seven-game series is because in a seven-game series, the preparation is absolutely meticulous. So do you have the personnel to win a seven-game series? You need short clock guys that can create their own shot. You need some stars, because anybody can beat anybody on one night. But can you counter preparation? When they take your best stuff away from you, can you break off plays and have individuals that can score on their own and that are big enough or that are talented enough that it doesn't matter how meticulous the preparation is, they're still going to get theirs, you know, the Durants and the younger Kobes, et cetera, and then answer the questions as what does the Howard move do. Now, how does that, if you got to play L.A. in a seven-game series starting tomorrow, what happens? You got to play San Antonio, seven-game series. Can you defend Tony Parker, Ginobili, and Duncan and win four out of seven? Can you beat the Lakers four out of seven? Can you beat Oklahoma City four out of seven? That's where the real answers lie.
So with the Lakers, I mean, Dwight Howard is huge, of course. I mean, I can't think of a better fit for the needs that team had. But do you even, when you look at the Lakers, again, you're saying, you know, we're building, so we need to think about, can we beat the Lakers 3 years from now or 4 years from now or 5 years from now?
Yeah, because do we worry about them? Yeah.
Do we worry about what that Nash is on that team?
You don't, because right now they're at a point, they're playing for an NBA title next year. You're building to evolve to eventually get there. So you look at it differently. You look at it for your young players after games when you can go to Anthony Davis and say, what was it like to be on the floor against Gasol and Dwight Howard and those guys? You know, you go to Austin Rivers. What was it like to be on the floor with Steve Nash, Kobe Bryant, and those guys? Now you go to your team. You see what they are? If that's what you aspire to be, now you have a point of comparison. It's an invaluable teaching tool when your young guys and your younger team has to go up against the best, because now it provides a coach with a motivational tool. You want to be the Lakers? This is why we're working hard. And sometimes the best thing that can happen is for a player to get crushed so you can tell him, you got crushed by a great one. Now you know what you need to do to get there so that doesn't happen to you again. Invaluable motivational tool. So the Hornets will use it as a different measuring stick versus Oklahoma City talking about the Los Angeles Lakers.
Right.
See the difference?
Let me throw one other thing out about this Dwight Howard trade and how maybe through a butterfly effect it could affect the Hornets. Last year, there was a debate over who the bigger team was in L.A. The Clippers were the younger, more exciting team. They were the one that, for the first time, you know, on the road, were also selling out. Chris Paul looked like, you know, he was the biggest, best player on, you know, what was becoming the most lovable team in L.A. Now this Dwight Howard trade puts the Lakers back front and center. There's no doubt over who the darling of L.A. is. Is there any chance that if, you know, we have a Clippers regression,
that he comes back?
Well, I guess that would be reading, you know, getting inside Chris Paul's mind, which we can't do. But you have pointed out numerous times on the podcast the point guard situation that the Hornets have to address. They have a ton of cap room, you know, coming up next year, and they'll actually have a roster full of talent that I would argue is as good or better than anything Chris Paul had any of his years here, and a coach in Monty Williams that he loves. If you were Dell Demps, would you at least keep that as a possibility and pursue him next summer, or has that ship just sailed and you're moving on?
Ships always appear to sail, but that's why they have rudders. They can turn around and change course. And you never, ever rule out anything that can happen, even if it's a 5% or a 10% chance. And because what players are doing now, they're scanning and they're looking at rosters. And as guys get further down in their career and they know the window slowly closes and the opportunity might not be there, they'll look. And if the Clippers don't continue to address that situation and they can't surpass the Lakers and take them down, you might see Chris Paul maybe wind up in a New York. Whether or not he can come back here, is it going to affect you have to give up pieces? Is it going to affect your cap? Where are you as a roster at that particular time? How close can he get you through a title? Because Chris Paul, I would think that next move is going to be, if he does make a next move, is I got to go to a team that's going to get me a title. You know, I got to have a title here because I'm not getting any younger. So I think that plays a major role. It's a great thought to have. I think it's a long shot because of the fact that he's going to, if that doesn't happen there, he's going to want to win big, because how much time do they have left in their career? Because he's seen what happened. He saw what happened with Dwayne Wade and others. He saw LeBron James have to bail. So nice thought.
Yeah.
Keep it out there. You never know. Dream about it. But right now I'd have to say it's a long shot.
Okay. I don't think we got any other questions for you. Did you have anything you wanted to bring up on the podcast or talk about?
No, other than on HornetsReport.com, I post my commandments behind right. every post that I keep up there, because like the one that I'm most frequently asked is, what do you mean? I just did an interview a couple of days ago. What do you mean that games are won while the ball is in the air? And my point to that is, when you're watching a basketball game and shots are taken, while the ball's in the air, look what happens below. The blockouts and who's pursuing missed shots. And the really good teams and the teams that can win and win big, they do the most with missed shots. Either it's a putback for an offensive rebound, either it's a reset for another play. And also the ball is in the air in the open floor when teams are advancing the ball off the pass in a fast break situation. Good defensive teams can deflect and get those passes while they're in the air. So much happens while the ball is in flight, and everybody watches the ball in flight, and they don't watch enough what's happening below that. Defensive players anticipating, who's slipping blockouts, who's altering the course of a primary rebounder. It's a lot of interesting stuff that goes on below the ball while everybody's looking up, staring at it.
Yeah, and I completely agree. I mean, last thing I want to say is thanks so much for coming on. And honestly, you know, the New Orleans basketball market, I would say, the landscape is fairly reasonably bare with people who really know what they're talking about on the game. Obviously, Jerry V does. Any of our listeners, I know tons of you are upset with, you know, kind of the reshuffling, but obviously Jerry V wants to stay in this market. We've got to do whatever it takes to keep him in this market, because, you know, personally, this last hour has been enlightening for me, and, you know, I really hope you stay in this market, and anything us or our fans or people at Hornets Report or Hornets 24/7 could do, please let us know, because we got to keep you in this market.
One send sandwiches. And any other snacks you don't have. And also, what excites me is the number of younger guys that are starting to follow the path of becoming basketball junkies. And I could sit around and talk about that. And guys like yourself and others, that next wave that's coming up, And I'll always tell you what the Dean Smiths and the Bobby Knights and the Mike Krzyzewskis, the Al McGuires and all the great ones always said, we all drink from wells we never dug. So you continue to pick brains, engage in a lot of dialogue, and you'll see you guys are the next wave that'll carry that. So when you guys are escorting me with my walker and I'm dribbling out of the side of my mouth and I'll go, I used to be somebody. You know, I'll have one of you guys go get me a hot dog or something.
All right, thanks a lot, Jerry.
Pleasure, fellas. Thanks for having me on. Absolute pleasure.
Much.
Ain't nothing but a party.